May it please the court, Your Honor, I'm Jonathan.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Jonathan Gould, and I represent the appellant in this case, Carmen Talavera. She brought her case of discrimination and retaliation against the appellee, the defendant, USAID, Rajesh Shah, the administrator. I'd like to start my argument with a quote from the Reeves case, and I think the court should be aware that you must have abundant and uncontroverted and independent evidence that no discrimination occurred in order to issue a summary judgment against a plaintiff in a discrimination case. And the court in this case ignored that well-established rule and did not make sure that the record had such evidence, and the defendant failed to present such evidence when it moved for summary judgment before the district court. And the court failed to heed this rule in issuing summary judgment against Ms. Talavera. Now, I'd like to start by reminding the court by looking at the firing issue first, because not only is that the most important part of the claim, but it's also the part where I think the court made its probably its most erroneous part of its decision. In its view of that, it failed to look at the record as a whole, and it fragmented the evidence. Let's look at what was before the court on that particular claim, what the evidence that Ms. Talavera presented, which the court is supposed to assume as being true and finding all inferences.
Is there a basic concern there that the district court weighed the evidence?
It weighed the evidence certainly in favor of the defendant, and it failed to look at all the evidence in its totality, the evidence that Ms. Talavera presented that showed definitive animus against her.
The only reason I presented that question that way, because the district court said he considered all the evidence, all right? So, I mean, that's in black and white. Now, you may agree, you may argue he didn't, but at least he thought he had. So that was my question.
Well, if it considered it, there was a long discussion on the firing issue of the last specific acts that caused the firing. There's no discussion of the previous evidence that would support our case that what was behind the intent of Mr. Blackshaw and Mr. Costin, who served as both prosecutors, judges, and juries on that firing, what was behind their intent when they were doing that. And we had a whole course of previous activity by both of these gentlemen, by both of these supervisors, that showed that they had animus against Ms. Talavera, not only because she was a woman, but because she was a woman who had opposed discrimination on several occasions. Let's start with her opposition with Mr. Costin in the trip in November of 2003. He tries to use what she told him, her complaints about the way she was being treated, being denied special awards like the men were, failing to allow her to serve as an acting supervisor when her supervisors were off on tours of duty. He uses that and a previous EEO claim that she brought about being denied a computer monitor to claim that she's crazy enough that she deserves to be sent to a psychiatric exam. And when that is found to be totally improper by the medical examiner.
That isn't the only reason that she was asked, they were concerned about a psychiatric exam, isn't it? Wasn't her behavior a bit erratic?
That's their claim. We are, in the record, our record is that her behavior was totally consistent with the way that she was being treated, and that's part of what the medical examiner thought as to why he didn't even want to go ahead. Yes, they did also mention her behavior at a meeting in which she found out that they were denying her the ability to go to Iraq on a schedule that she thought had been previously established.
Shifted 1 month.
I'm sorry,
Your Honor? Shifted her from 1 month to another?
I believe they shifted her about 2 months. But it was not only the shift, they knew it was inconvenient, it was the way that it happened. They had held what appeared to her to be secret meetings in which they undid a verbal agreement that she had with Mr. Blackshaw to set the schedule for her to go to Iraq. She was the first volunteer to go and should have gone first.
The other evidence was the fact that everybody claimed she had been at the meeting where this matter had been discussed. She denied it, but everybody else said she had been present. And that was one of Mr. Costin's points.
That's his claim, but a lot of this was being put forward by another acting supervisor, Mr. Singleton, who had specifically told her he didn't think women should go to Iraq. He was kind of the ringleader setting up the schedule. Again, someone who is an acting supervisor and a male who specifically told her that. So
she was sent to Iraq.
The question wasn't whether she was going to go. They were trying to make it difficult, but she did eventually go to Iraq in July, I believe. That is true. She did do her tour of duty there. But before she goes, remember, another key event occurs is that she gets the Costin email memo to Dr. DeCastro, and she confronts Mr. Costin about it, asks him, tells him she's going to file an EEO complaint, and he bursts out, in anger toward her. And his whole demeanor changes. As bad as it was before that, it gets even worse, and it builds up. And 8 days later, she finds out she's denied a promotion to a job by Mr. Struford in an area that she used to work under, and she files and she amends her EEO claim about that. 3 months later, when she returns from Iraq, she applies for another promotion before Mr. Blackshaw and finds out that a male has been pre-selected for the position, or at least she's been ruled out for the position before the interviews. She goes to Mr. Blackshaw about that right after filing another EEO complaint about that denial. He again gets visibly angry. Her performance evaluation is called into question by Mr. Costin. There's another incident in which he gets angry at her after there's a meeting about the EEO case in December. All of this is building up. And then in February, there's an incident where Mr. Costin blocks her from leaving her office, all at the same time that they're using events in February, right around the same time that all of this is occurring. And again, there's also an incident in March where Mr. Blackshaw gets visibly angry at her. Total demeanor change. She's an excellent employee before all of this happens. And you see in the evaluations how she's rated. And she goes from there to not only being a bad employee, but someone who they continually challenge her credibility. Now, why does that occur? Well, the timing. And we get an inference from the timing alone that was related. But, you can also tell from the demeanor of these gentlemen. None of that comes out in the district court opinion. It's not even mentioned. It's like it doesn't exist. And you can't discuss the firing and claim that all of these two gentlemen who had this supposed honest belief, which is a credibility finding in itself, you can't say that when there's all this evidence of the record that they held all of these things against you. At least a jury could find that based on the evidence. So you can't ignore that. And then let's look at the reasons they pick. Here's an employee, a 30-year employee, who knows that these gentlemen are angry at her and are sort of out to get her. They're interfering with her performance evaluations at this point. They've denied her 2 promotions. They're getting visibly angry at her. Here's this employee. They're watching her, and she supposedly submits a draft travel threat assessment where they're clearly marked a draft, where they're supposedly she makes comments about security arrangements that they accuse her of, that she knows that they're false, when all she's doing is following the procedure, and there's evidence in the record how she had done this on previous occasions.
But I don't understand why she would file a draft with a misrepresentation.
Well, because, Your Honor, her testimony is that she needed to get this out. Her practice was, if she didn't have the final arrangements, it's clearly marked a draft, and she had done this before with Ireland when she was working in the area, that she would put down the preliminary arrangements as best that she could, and she was very upfront in her emails as to what she was doing. If that was somehow a procedural mistake, she wasn't aware of it, and the jury could easily find she wasn't aware of it, and that's the key issue also that the court ignores. The issue is whether she intentionally did this to misrepresent something. If she just made a mistake, she can't be fired for that. You know, perhaps she should be counseled, but she can't be fired for that. And the court turns it all around and fails to recognize this fact. The court finds that this is just an office, that she violated office policy and should be fired for that. Well, we don't even know if it was a policy. The evidence is disputed on that. But what's clear is, based on her past behavior, that she didn't know it was an office policy. So how could she be accused of intentionally misrepresenting anything? In addition, that travel threat assessment, when the information came in, was sent out properly. Her supervisors were well aware of what was going on, and there was no danger to the administrator when he eventually traveled to Afghanistan. So they blew that totally out of proportion. Why? Because the evidence, at least if you look at it as you're supposed to, and draw the inferences in Ms. Talavera's favor, was because she had opposed discrimination 3 or 4 different times, and they had visibly negatively reacted toward that. Now, the second issue on the McDermott comment is very similar. Why would somebody, again, who first of all, the dates are all in dispute. Mr. Blackshaw claims it happened starting in February. He says on or about February 21st. He's never very clear. And the words are very, very important here. The difference between what her story is and what Mr. Blackshaw's story is are very close. So the words are crucial here. If he's really wants to solidify the reasons why he's doing this to her, why would she deliberately lie to him, knowing that he was in contact with the Kabul XO, Mr. McDermott, because they were concerned? He was the man in charge of getting these final arrangements made for the administrator's trip. So why would she, knowing that there's all this animus and they're watching her, why would she deliberately make up a story that this person had apologized? It doesn't make any sense, and the judge never even considers this, never looks at it. In addition, again, there were all sorts of disputes about when this happened. There's evidence in the record that Blackshaw is trying to claim that she changed her story, and Mr. Manchester, who was the acting director of SEC at the time, there was a meeting with him in which he has another story about that she didn't change her story. So the facts are all in dispute about what happened. And if you look at Ms. Talavera's version, as you're supposed to, on summary judgment, her version clearly shows that they had no reason, and they were doing this intentionally for obvious reasons that were just made up because of her EEO complaints and because she was a woman who had opposed discrimination. I think I've gone way over my time, so if there are any other questions, we haven't even got to the other issues yet, but the record is long, and I'll let my co-counsel reply, and I guess I've reserved about a minute and a half.
All right. Thank you.
May it please the court. I want to start, because Ms. Talavera's attorney has said that this is a course of events, I want to start with her first claim, which involves the February 2004 request for a mental health screening examination. And I think one of the most important things about this request...
It wasn't her request.
It was not her request. It was a request made, but I think one of the most important things to factually to focus on is that the request was not made by her supervisors. Rather, the request was made by Martha Reese, who was a healthcare service provider at USAID. What happened was that...
Based on what her supervisors told her.
That's correct. Her supervisors, Mr. Blackshaw said that in all his 20 years of experience, he had never had a situation where an employee suddenly said that she was not at an important meeting where they were trying to decide who was going to go to Iraq on what kind of schedule. At least three other individuals at the meeting said she was there, and she claimed that she wasn't. He had never had that kind of situation before, and so he sought guidance as to what he should do. He did not decide that he should automatically request some kind of mental health screening. And because she was going to go to Iraq, a war zone, Martha Reese suggested that because she was going to have to be cleared by the Department of State doctors anyway, that that clearance also include a mental health screening component. As to whether or not the doctor at the Department of State thought that that request was appropriate, Dr. Feinstein, that's clearly an admissible hearsay. Ms. Talavera claims that he said he didn't think it was appropriate. He wasn't USAID's agent. He was a Department of State doctor. USAID did not send her specifically to him. In fact, there was a Dr. Castro, originally assigned to her case. USAID had no control over that doctor at all.
Is it disputed that no psychiatric examination was conducted?
There's absolutely no dispute that there was no examination conducted. So
that was the government's position.
That's correct.
So, despite her supervisors informing Mrs. Reeves, was it?
Ms. Reeves, yes, Your Honor.
Ms. Reeves, of these events and sending it over, it never happened.
It never happened. As the district court said, Your Honor, the examination request stands alone.
The doctor was incompetent, or there was no basis for it. I mean, doesn't she get the inferences here?
I don't think so, not based on inadmissible hearsay, Your Honor.
No, there's no inadmissible hearsay. I just asked you. It's undisputed that no psychiatric exam was conducted.
That's correct.
Despite her supervisor's concerns and what they told Ms. Reese and Mrs. Reese's referral.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the doctor asked Mr. Costin to write up his concerns.
Does she get any inferences? That's all I'm asking.
I don't think so based on this record. And the reason I say that is because the doctor...
We're talking about a course of conduct here.
That's correct.
So they refer her for a psychiatric exam, and it never happens. Now, what's the next incident?
The next incident after this...
What does the record say as to why she didn't have a psychiatric exam?
It doesn't say, Your Honor, but if I might just point out in the record at Joint Appendix 591, which is Mr. Costin's email to the doctor at the Department of State, he specifically says that he is requesting that appropriate tests be given because he has a concern about Ms. Talavera's difficulty in reasoning. That's what's sent to the doctor. And then he lists several incidents in that email.
Is it disputed that Dr., and I may get the names wrong, but DeSalle and
Feinstein.
Feinstein were psychiatrists?
I don't believe so.
All right, yeah.
So it may well be that they determined when they got the email that it was not of such severity that it warranted a mental health screening request. But that doesn't mean that the request for one, based on circumstances where someone says, I didn't attend a meeting and everyone else said you were there, wasn't...
All we're talking about is summary judgment here and what inferences the plaintiff gets. And so you said you want to talk about this course of conduct. So that's all I'm getting at. So what's the next course?
Well, Your Honor, of course, the next one is the June 4th, 2004, the June 2004 non-selection, where she applied for the position of security specialist,
right,
and was not selected by Mr. Struffert. Now, this position was in a different division than where she was. This was
her evidence, as I understand it, is Mr. Flannery, who was the director, made the statement about Mr. Struffert?
She submitted evidence that Mr. Flannery, at some point in time between 2001 and 2003,
when she spoke to him about her concern about being passed over for promotion, he made this statement, right?
If you're talking about the Mr. Flannery's statement about what Mr. Struffert said,
no, about Mr. Struffert's attitude toward women.
There's no context for that one.
When she went to talk to him about why she was being passed over, and he said, he made this statement about Mr. Struffert. I'm just saying this is evidence, all right? Whether or not a prior fact, grants judgment is a totally different question, but I'm just trying to go through it.
Your Honor,
so
my...
She has a statement from Mr. Flannery, who's the director. Then Mr. Struford destroys his notes, contrary to the agency's policy, right?
That's correct, but Your Honor, if I might add that the Flannery statement was not made, there is no evidence in the record that Mr. Flannery told Ms. Talavera that Mr. Struford had problems with women after she wasn't selected. That's the whole point the district court made, is that we don't know when Mr. Flannery made this statement. We don't know when Mr.
When she went to complain about her not being promoted. That we know. It wasn't as though Mr. Flannery just out of the blue said it one day.
Well, the district court said that we don't know when Mr. Flannery told her.
You don't know whether it was a Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday? I mean, we don't, but I'm just trying to get, we're talking about the inferences that the plaintiff gets, all right? She has that statement. Then she has the selecting official destroying his interview notes, contrary to agency policy.
That's correct, but it was his usual practice to destroy the note.
But she was fired when she submitted a draft statement that had these remarks in it, and that was her normal practice. Now, you can't have it both ways.
Actually, right? they're different, Your Honor. They're completely different.
I know they're different, but I mean, there's an office, an agency policy that you don't destroy notes, and the fact that a supervisor is doing it, is violating agency policy continually, doesn't make it right.
It doesn't make it right.
And it prejudices the plaintiff.
It doesn't.
Because she can't get the information about the questions that were asked.
It doesn't make it discrimination or retaliation because it's a violation of office policy.
Course of conduct, counsel.
I understand that, Your Honor. But if I might, with respect to that destruction of notes, Ms. Talavera never attested that she did well in the interview. She never said, I did really well in the interview, and if we had these notes, I could prove that I did well.
And you think she that would be enough to defeat summary judgment?
I think that would have helped her case. I'm not saying no. I don't think it would have been enough to defeat summary judgment.
Okay.
But she never made that assertion, and so I think under the normal spoliation of evidence.
She has to say that her failure to say that she was the best qualified, even though she was ranked that way, defeats her opposition to summary judgment?
She wasn't ranked that way. That was a self-assessment score, Your Honor, that she did.
But everybody was asked to do self-assessments.
That's correct. And those scores were not the determining factor. They were self-assessment scores. The interviews were.
The interviews were. And, of course, the notes have been destroyed.
But she didn't testify that she did well at the interview.
All right.
And that was certainly within her control to be able to testify. And that's exactly like this court's decision in Carter.
And then we would have a credibility contest, wouldn't we, with Mr. Stuford saying she did terribly, and she would be saying she did well.
Your problem is she has not submitted any claim that she did well.
Absolutely.
So there's no controversy.
There's no credibility issue here, and it's exactly like what this court pointed out in the Carter case, where the court said that the plaintiff could have said that she did well at the interview and did not. So in that sense, this is very similar to that particular case.
And your argument on the destruction of the notes is that it would only be an inference of discrimination if the individual had done so in this case and not done so in other cases. Whether it's in violation of policy or not is irrelevant on the issue of his discriminatory motive. Is that your point?
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's what this court said in Webb, that you have to have a conscious, you have to be consciously trying to destroy evidence or gross negligence or some bad faith.
But that's at the judgment stage. We're at summary judgment, and we only have his word that he did this before.
Then it's unrebutted evidence.
Unrebutted evidence. All right.
It's unrebutted evidence, Your Honor, and therefore the employer is certainly entitled to have that evidence considered in summary judgment on the employer's behalf.
And so she would have to offer evidence to show that in the past he had destroyed his notes
She has to offer some evidence that he has a culpable state of mind, as this court said in Webb versus District of Columbia, and she offers none with respect to the destruction.
Okay.
So
what about
that gets her nowhere.
No. It's still there.
It's
the question
there, but
is, you know, drip, 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 drip. Let's see what she ends up with. Now she has statistical information.
Well, I think that's a generous word for the information that she relies on, Your Honor.
Well, the EEO officer of the agency thought it was significant statistical information.
The EEO officer wrote Mr. Blackshaw,
yes,
and he talked about what the snapshot of the office looked like and the selections. But the reason I say that calling it statistics is generous is because that EEO officer made clear that there was a problem with applicants and said, if you want our help, please ask us so that you can have more qualified, highly qualified women to consider. So without knowing how many women were applying for the jobs, there's no way you can consider that evidence or give it any weight as statistics. But the district court did. The district court gave plaintiff the benefit and considered the statistical evidence and said, it's not enough. And the district court was correct in that regard.
Okay. And then we have the hearsay of the other applicant who said he was asked different questions.
But that's clearly an admissible hearsay. The district court was absolutely right, and that this court's decision in Carter is right on point, where an interviewee tried in Carter to claim that different questions had been asked, and this court said that's impermissible hearsay. The same is true with Mr. Lazard here. He was not an agent of the employer to be able to speak about the interview process. So that's evidence. You cannot look at inadmissible evidence and say this all piles up against the employer.
I said that was inadmissible. I'm clear about that. But I just want to be clear as to what you think she had to show. First of all, she had to say she did very well in the interviews. All right?
Your Honor, I think she should have shown that she was better qualified for the position. I mean, under this court's decisions Jackson and also in ACCA and in Jackson, that you have to show that your qualifications are significantly better than the selectee in order to cast any doubt on the selection decision. She doesn't do that. She doesn't show that she did well with the interview.
I guess I don't understand your view of what her theory is, just so I'm clear about this. Her theory is they don't have any women at GS-14s. And the evidence is, well, they had some women, but those women have gone. So it's all male. And she keeps applying for these positions. And in the one area where she had worked before, because everybody was giving self-evaluations, whether you got the promotion turned on how well you did at the interview. And we don't know whether she did well at the interview or not. And her theory, I thought, was, yeah, because of the types of questions she would ask. They were different.
But that's the relying, if you say the types of questions she asked, they were different, that's relying on inadmissible hearsay from Mr. Lazard that they were different. So I think it's important, couple points I want to make as my time is running out, get to the reasons for the termination, because it's very important to focus on the fact that the suggested termination was made by the Human Resources Department. It was not made by Mr. Blackshaw or Mr. Costin.
They said it was close, right? But because it was the administrator.
No, they said they referred the issues to Human Resources and said, we think some action should be taken. You decide what to take. And it was the Human Resources Department that said, well, either one of these offenses are terminable offenses. I see my time is up. May I continue to answer?
Sure.
Thank you. Either one of these offenses are terminable offenses. And with respect to the misrepresentation, her claim that you can just stamp a document draft and make up anything, it's not worth the piece of paper it's written on. She had no basis for any of those security arrangements that she put in because she had not gotten a return email from Afghanistan, and her email to Afghanistan said, are there going to be any security arrangements? Not what will they be?
So why was it her statement that these reports had to be submitted?
The record is not clear as to why she chose to submit this report on February 2nd before she heard anything back from Afghanistan.
No, she heard the guy, what is his name?
James McDermott.
No, she wasn't responding. She had been trying to get him to respond.
Right, so she made it up.
And she said, this is the way the office operated, and I had never been told that this wasn't the correct way, and I would change it. Once I got the information from Mr. McDermott.
But there's no evidence that in her prior assessments she ever let her supervisors know she was making things up. There's no evidence in the record of that. And I might add that, if I might just continue for a moment, Your Honor, that she says in after she was chastised for making it up, she said, well, I will add whatever I need to when I hear from the executive officer, Mr. McDermott, in Afghanistan. It wasn't a matter of adding. She had put things in this document for which there was no basis whatsoever. Clearly, a reasonable jury would conclude that Mr. Blackshaw had a reasonable belief that she was making a misrepresentation of a material fact. And that's not a credibility finding.
Am I recollecting correct that this related to the administrator's travel to Afghanistan?
Absolutely.
Iraq?
The head of the agency was traveling to Afghanistan. To Afghanistan, that's correct. And she was supposed to provide a threat assessment for his security. So no reasonable jury could believe that Mr. Blackshaw did not have a reasonable belief that she had made a material misrepresentation of fact. And the same is true with respect to the second ground on which, with respect to giving false information, and I think we've laid that out thoroughly in our brief. So if I might just conclude, Your Honor, Judge Rogers, with your focus on the totality of the events, which is absolutely clear. That's what the district court needed to do. But this case is like a play with four acts. And if the play is about a murder, there needs to be a murder in one of those acts. There is no discrimination in any of the acts that lead up to her termination or to her termination, nor is there any retaliation. And therefore,
well, that is not the question, is it? All right.
There.
I mean, she has offered evidence. Now, maybe she hasn't offered enough, but we couldn't write an opinion saying there's no discrimination, could we?
There is not enough to survive summary judgment, and therefore we urge the court to affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment in this case.
Okay, thank you.
Just a few things, Your Honors, starting at the end on the firing. Counsel said it was clear. She was very upfront in her emails. Mr. Blackshaw knew exactly what was going on, and if he thought there was some question, she certainly provided a reasonable explanation in the number of weeks that it took. And if this was such a horrible act, why did it take 8 months to fire her?
Well, let me just make clear. I looked at some of the emails, but are you saying in those emails she was saying that her draft contained false information?
No, it was, of course not, Your Honor, but they knew about the problem that she was having getting the information that she needed. She did not even know
Why did she submit the report then if she didn't have the information?
Because she was worried about being late. She did not only did she not have the information about where exactly the itinerary was, but she didn't even have the dates. There is some evidence in the record that she was going away for the Washington birthday holiday. So for what she knew, she needed to prepare this report without any notice. So and she had been called on in the Ireland assessment to do this, and it was her practice where she was under a time gun and she wasn't being given the information, and she explained all this to them many times before they actually fired her. So even if they had some question, why are they so adamant, no matter what her explanation is? She gives them the records. Costa knows she's done this before.
What they were supposed to do with this. I mean, it was a useless piece of paper.
Well, let's look what they did do with it.
No, but I mean, why would a supervisor spend any time looking at a document that has false information in it if he knew it was false information?
Well,
I mean, it doesn't make any sense, does it?
Well, the question is, why would he attack somebody and fire her for that reason as well?
We're talking about security here.
Well, I mean, I guess they, you know, under their theory is that once you put that information in, it can never be retracted and updated, even though you're put on notice, draft, right on the top. Can I just go back to a couple of other things? I'm sorry.
I didn't,
yeah, go ahead.
Counsel for the agency was pointing out in connection with the June 4th non-promotion that the plaintiff never claims that she did well during the interview.
Well, the reasons that Mr., and I don't want to confuse, they're very similar positions around the same time. I think there was a little confusion. It's the second interview that where she was not prepped and the males were prepped that she says she did not do well. The first interview.
I'm talking about the June.
Right, in the June. The November.
Focus on the June.
Right, but I wanted to point that out to the court because I think there was some confusion on counsel's part.
I don't think there was
part.
Any confusion.
Okay, I'm sorry.
All right. I'm focusing on counsel's statement that as to the June 2004 non-promotion, the plaintiff never claimed she did well in the interviews.
Well, she claimed, Your Honor, that she knew all the information about this industrial security program that Mr. Struford claims was the main reason why, that she didn't have any information, she didn't impart any information. And she does say that she did have that information, so of course she had reasonable inferences.
The of course was a jump, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Judge?
Your statement starting with of course was a jump.
Well, it's in the record where she documented what she had done in this unit on this particular program that Mr. Struford.
Judge Rogers keeps asking a very simple question.
Okay.
Did the plaintiff ever say that she imparted that information in the interview, that she did well in the interview?
She said that she responded to the questions as best as she could and that she knew the information. She knew the area that Mr. Struford was asking questions about.
She could say, you could say, I knew, there I've been in situations where I thought afterwards, gee, I knew all that, but why didn't I say it? There's a gap there, isn't there?
So we won't find, is that, I just want to be clear, I just want to give you the opportunity. I wasn't suggesting counsel was misrepresenting, but I wanted to be clear that you agree that we will not find in the record anything to suggest that she was claiming she did well in the interviews and she was, therefore, should have gotten the job, should have been promoted, and the only reason she didn't was because either.
Well,
gender or the retaliation?
It's very, I think the record is that she knew the information, and she was very clear about that, that she was asked at the interview whether she particularly on this particular promotion used the words, I did well at the interview. Not sure the record shows that, but I don't think that's her burden to show that.
I thought you were going to refer to the fact that in the record it does say she interviews well.
Well, you know, these are very general terms, Your Honor.
No, but we're talking here course of conduct and we're talking specific incidents. So at this point, I was talking with counsel about the June 2004,
right.
And I took all the information that you had pointed us to and went through it. And it seemed to me that what counsel was pointing out was fairly serious.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree, because even if she didn't use those specific words, I interviewed well.
That effect.
She clearly set forth before this court and in her statements that Mr. Struford's claim that she didn't know at the interview, she didn't know the job. She clearly, and I have the record over here, if I might just for a second. If you look at her rebuttal affidavit to Mr. Struford's affidavit at the EEO, during the EEO investigation, she talks about all the knowledge that she had of this National Industrial Security Program, which to Struffert was the key issue that he said that she didn't impart. So I think, obviously, a reasonable inference is that she imparted that information to Mr. Struffert. Again, the record...
Where is this in the record?
This is on page 572 of the of the joint appendix.
Right.
And it's part of her rebuttal affidavit to Struffert's very specific description of why she didn't do well. So I think it's certainly a reasonable inference from there to say, then why would she have this information and not impart it to Mr. Struffert? Again, the record is sparse on this because of the spoliation issue. We would know all the answers to these questions, at least from the defense standpoint, if we had those records. We wouldn't need Mr. Lessard's testimony if we had those records. And by the way, the standard that the agency and the appellee seems to hold us to is much higher than the Webb case holds us to. And the court held us to this bad faith standard. We get no inference in our favor unless we prove bad faith. That's not the law. The law is, and the facts of this case, that these documents were intentionally destroyed. Mr. Struffert knew what he was doing. Whether we can prove he did it to cover up something, that's for the jury to decide. It's not for the court. And for to keep typifying this as a negligence issue, I think, is not what the evidence shows and is not what the case law shows. As to Dr. Feinstein, I have to say that to say that's hearsay is really, I think, way off base.
We don't have an affidavit from Dr. Feinstein, do we?
No, but they themselves put in her testimony about what Dr. Feinstein told her. If he's not an agent, if not a direct employee, after all, he did work for the Department of State. And he writes an opinion saying that Ms. Talavera is crazy and shouldn't go to Iraq. Are they trying to tell this court that they wouldn't rely on that and ignore it? Of course he was acting as their agent. Why do you think he was sent? And if he wasn't, then that would make the exam even more illegal. So, I mean, this argument, I think, is way off base, and the court shouldn't treat it seriously.
Anything further?
No, I don't have anything further unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Your advisement.
Okay.
Oh.